Coming up, a look at Beirut the day after what's being called a peaceful intifada. But first, in Chicago, a federal judge returned home last night to find her husband and aged mother shot to death in the basement of the family home. While police are cautioning against drawing conclusions, the judge was the target of a failed murder plot a year ago, for which white supremacist Matthew Hale is serving jail time, and his followers have been posting threatening information about her family on the Internet. David Heinzman is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And David, this must be shocking news in Chicago.
It is a very shocking piece of news. The judge is a very well-respected judge, and when Matt Hale was charged with conspiring to try and kill her, it was very big news here. And so to have, less than a year later, two members of her family actually murdered in her home is very shocking.
Well, in addition to the ties to a white supremacist organization, we understand that there was a bulletin released in the last 2 weeks that federal agents in Chicago were aware of.
Yeah, we actually don't know a whole lot about the details of that, but clearly there was some evidence out there that white supremacist groups were sort of ramping up their rhetoric about doing harm to public officials recently.
Well, remind us of Judge Joan Lefkow's connection with white supremacist Matthew Hale.
Hale was sued in 2002 by an unrelated group in the Pacific Northwest who had a name similar to his organization, which is called the World Church of the Creator. They sued him for copyright infringement. And Lefkow originally actually ruled in Hale's favor, but an appeals court overturned that and said he had to change the name. He refused to do that, and she eventually held him in contempt and sanctioned him $200,000 to demanding that he change the name of his group. And it was at that stage that this alleged plot began to emerge.
It was discovered by an undercover FBI agent.
It was actually discovered by there was an inner circle member of Hale's group who the FBI turned as an informant, and he wore a wire and tape-recorded conversations with Hale.
In which Hale seemed to be commissioning this person to kill Judge Lefkow.
Yeah, I mean, Hale's lawyers would say that that's not what he said, but on the tape, it's clear that he is giving the message that if somebody in his circle wants to do harm to the judge, then he, it has his blessing.
Well, now we understand that because of that, Matthew Hale is in jail under terrorism laws. Explain that.
Well, he is he's going to be sentenced next in April, and because of the alleged threats in the past, he has been held under very, very strict measures, cutting off community with the outside world, and can communicate only with the judge who is going to sentence him in April. And that judge is not Judge Lefkow. It's a different federal judge.
Well, so what is the thinking? Again, police have cautioned not to rush to judgment, but if Matthew Hale can't communicate with anyone, how might he have been at all involved in the murder of Judge Lefkow's husband and mother?
Well, I don't know any of us want to speculate that he was involved in this murder, but clearly the focus of the investigation at this point is on white supremacist groups who have posted the Lefkow's home address on websites, and there's been a great deal of some nasty rhetoric about them because of the judge's involvement in Hale's case. So they're clearly looking at white supremacists and followers of Hale.
Judge Lefkow was, in fact, under police protection starting in 2003 because of threats from Matthew Hale. Did that protection taper off?
It did. We were told that there was at one point a camera focused on her house that federal agents monitored, and that there were plainclothes officers on her block most of the time. And after his conviction, that began to taper off, and the judge, while being concerned, was not overly concerned about her personal safety.
Well, as we said, Chicago must be rattled today.
Yeah, and talking to people, anti-defamation groups around the country, and civil rights groups around the country, they feel like the whole country is going to sort of be rocked a little bit by this, because if this is the way that the investigation goes, and they continue to focus on the white supremacist groups retaliating against the judge, then this is something that will be felt by civil rights and anti-defamation groups across the country.
That sends quite a chill. Speaking of which, does anyone think that it's important that yesterday was the 12th anniversary of the government raid on David Koresh's compound in Waco, Texas?
That's definitely something they're looking at. We heard that last night. I think it's too early to really sort out you know, all of these leads, and I think they're not ruling anything out, but it's the, you know, all those things are definitely of interest.
David Heinzman is a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. David, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome.
Now to Beirut. Over 100 Lebanese protesters have erected a tent city near the grave of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, vowing to stay until Syrian troops are pulled from the country. Yesterday, 2 weeks after Hariri's assassination, the government resigned. And today, the English-language newspaper The Daily Star editorialized that the tens of thousands of protesters in the streets electrified the country and could lead to revolution against Syria. In London, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice echoed the call.
The Lebanese people are beginning to express their aspirations for democracy, their aspirations that they be able to carry out their political aspirations without foreign interference.
In a moment, the bigger picture on the prospects for democracy in the region. But first, joining us on the line from Beirut is reporter Nicholas Blandford. He writes for the Christian Science Monitor. And Nicholas, the White House is calling what's happening in Lebanon the Cedar Revolution, after the cedar tree in the Lebanese flag. This is unprecedented in Lebanon. What are people saying?
Well, I think very much the opposition here trying to emulate what happened in Ukraine back in November with the Orange Revolution, and as you may recall, happened in Czechoslovakia with the Velvet Revolution. They are trying to get things changed here through peaceful means, but by through mass popular protests. So they're bringing the people out into the streets. And these are not normally the people you might associate with anti-Syrian demonstrations, like students and so on. This is a very diverse array of Lebanese society. It cuts across the sectarian divide. You have Christians there, you have Sunni Muslims, you have some Shia Muslims, you have the Druze. And you also have a broad array of Lebanese society. You have the students, of course, and you've also got bankers, and you have doctors, you have the bourgeoisie there.
You say the opposition actually has called it the Peaceful Intifada.
That's right, yes. The Peaceful Intifada, this was the name that was conjured up 2 weeks ago in the aftermath of the assassination of Rafik Hariri, which snowballed the whole protest movement here.
Well, there are huge demonstrations yesterday. First of all, are there as many people in the street today? And as spontaneous as these demonstrations have been, tell us about how highly orchestrated they were behind the scenes.
Yeah, there is a lot of spontaneity in this, in terms of people feeling that now is a time to come out and protest, people that perhaps wouldn't have done so in the past. But of course, there has to be a level of organization behind this. So the opposition leadership will call for a particular rally for a particular date. There has been a continuous presence, I should add, in Martyr Square, which is the hub of the city center and where Rafik Hariri was buried. His grave has become something of a shrine. So you have, at any one time, several hundred people gathered around his grave. Now, behind the scenes, behind all this, there are some of the youth movements of the political groups that are collectively part of the opposition mobilizing their resources, staying in touch with each other. They're producing banners. They're producing posters. The organizers and participants in these demonstrations have been using SMS messaging to alert protesters that, you know, to take alternative routes if the main roads are blocked, that they should take side roads and that sort of thing.
The current Prime Minister, Omar Karami, has been asked to stay on to be caretaker of the government until change can be implemented. Is there any sense that the pro-Syrian president of Lebanon, Amil Lahoud, will follow the Prime Minister and resign as well?
Not at this stage. I think most Lebanese, most analysts here that I've spoken to feel that Mr. Lahoud will not resign, certainly at this early stage in the game. There is a crucial meeting tomorrow of the opposition leadership, and they're going to have to decide what is the next course of action for them. Do they want to confront Mr. Lahoud, the president, now, and force a confrontation whereby he might be forced to resign, or maybe to escalate it to forming a military government, which is one option that is being discussed by some analysts here.
And Nick, what's the sense of the people, you know, on the ground? Jubilation, joy yesterday, but today it must be tempered. Syria has not yet spoken. Is there a sense of, geez, what have we done? Or nervousness, is, you know, to the unknown of the future? How are people feeling?
Yeah, yesterday was clearly jubilation. Today, people have a more sober assessment of what's going on. Certainly, the country has embarked on a path from which there is no turning back now. There's no
no question that we're going to return to the status quo ante. So people are concerned because the future is not as clear as perhaps it was just before 2 weeks ago.
Nicholas Blanford is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Beirut, Lebanon. Well, we turn now to veteran Middle East watcher Professor Fawaz Jurjes, who teaches Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. And Professor Jurjes, first, your assessment of the near future in Lebanon. Do you think the president might resign?
No, I doubt it very much. Let's remember that the current crisis was precipitated by Mr. Lahoud, because he and the Syrian government forced the Lebanese parliament and forced most, members of the parliament to revise the constitution in order to extend his term 3 more years. And I think that particular, revision of the constitution was basically brought about the resignation of Rafiq Hariri, who was assassinated 2 weeks ago. The man is obsessed with, maintaining power, and he serves as the behest of Syria. This is the crucial point. And as long as Syria would like Amir Lahoud to remain in the presidential palace, I think he will remain there.
Well, in fact, Syrian President Assad has given only one interview to the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, saying the only way he'd withdraw the country's 14,000 troops from Lebanon is if there's a peace deal with Israel. Can you remind us of what Syria regards as its role in the region and what he may have meant by that statement?
Well, I think this has been the Syrian line all along, that not only Syrian troops, by the way, Syrian troops entered Lebanon in 1990 because they were given green light by the President Bush Sr. During the second Gulf War in 1991. And the Syrians have always made it very clear they are in Lebanon not only to maintain stability in the country, but also to make sure that Lebanon serves as a strategic card in their negotiations with Israel. And now what I think President Bashar al-Assad said yesterday, he reiterated that particular line, is that he said, quote unquote, we can pull out our troops before the end of the year from Lebanon. But strategically, he said, that can take place only if we obtain serious guarantees. In other words, peace. That means really making Lebanon hostage to a future Arab-Israeli peace settlement. This is truly a major problem for both Lebanon and the opposition in Lebanon.
We want to hear more from you about that, to hear the intricacies of that relationship. But we're going to take a quick break. Before we do, I know you have relatives in Lebanon. In the few seconds we have now, what are they saying?
Well, I think this is really the Lebanese are living in a historical moment. Tragic as it was, I think the assassination of Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri brought about a sense of unity. The Lebanese are, for the first time, probably in many years, are united. They're united over the fact they would like their independence, their freedom. Many of my colleagues and friends are saying that they finally see...
Hold that thought, because we want to know what your friends are saying, and we want to know more about the region from you. And we will. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation on the prospects for democracy in the Middle East with Professor Fawaz Jurjes, who teaches Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. And Professor, you were just saying that your relatives in Lebanon are reacting to what's happening there. Please continue, because I understand that even people like your very non-political sister want to take to the streets.
Absolutely. And I think, my sister was never really a political activist, yet she felt she has an 8-month baby, and she said she felt really like taking her baby and being part of that particular demonstration. I think you're witnessing what we are witnessing in Lebanon now is a dynamic civil society. Neither the devastating civil war in Lebanon between 1975 and 1990, nor the nor Syria's military and security presence, basically has been able to devour Lebanese civil society. And as I said, there's a sense of unity, a sense that sectarian differences are being put aside. And let's hope that out of this particular tragedy and social upheaval, a new social and political contract emerges. That is a democratic one, where an inclusive democratic Lebanon for all the Lebanese emerges.
But as we were saying, standing right in the way is Syria. Would you just tell us a little bit more about this complicated relationship between Syria, Hezbollah, the militant group based in Lebanon, Israel? What is the complication there? What is happening there?
Well, I think what we need to understand is that I think there are multiple fault lines in the region. I mean, I think we cannot really understand what's happening in Lebanon without understanding the simmering, continuing Arab-Israeli conflict and the war raging in Iraq. The Syrians, President Bashar al-Assad yesterday in an interview with the Italian newspaper La Repubblica, he made it very clear that Syria is being targeted by the Americans. And he made it very clear that will we be the next target of Israel and the White House? And he said, quote unquote, all of this has been written for a long time. Iraq was the first place, then it will be Iran's and Syria's turn. And what's happening in Lebanon, I think the Syrians are behaving as if they will be the next target on Washington's list. And they're saying, listen, Lebanon is not just a military base for us. Lebanon represents a strategic bargaining chip with both Washington and Israel. So in this particular sense, he made it very clear, without a settlement of the Arab-Israeli conflict, without a vision in Iraq and the region, Syria feels very obliged to remain in Lebanon and to maintain, of course, Hezbollah being, and by the way, Hezbollah has not come out with the opposition calling for Syria's pull out of Lebanon. Syria, Hezbollah has maintained its position that Syria's position and presence in the country is needed.
Well, but then we recently saw elections being held by Palestinians, by the Iraqis. The president of Egypt announced over the weekend that his country would hold open elections for the first time ever. Unprecedented street protests in Lebanon, the toppling of a prime minister. You know, there is the sense that this argument that Syria is making is sort of on shaky ground right now, and that there's an outbreak of democracy in the Middle East that's beyond their calls for, holding Lebanon hostage, as you said. What's your sense of that?
I think you're absolutely correct. I think we should really focus on the big picture. The winds of democratic change have finally reached Arab and Muslim shores. And I would argue that the genie is out of the box. And let's remember, you asked me about Syria and the complication. I think the Syrians are terrified that if they pull out of Lebanon, their very survival, the survival of the Baathist regime in Damascus, would be online. They're terrified that the reverberations of the Lebanese crisis would likely reach Damascus shores. And this is why I think what we are witnessing today in Palestine, in Egypt, in Lebanon, even in Syria, I mean, there is a tremendous social upheaval in Syria itself. Many voices are calling for a democratic opening in Damascus itself. And this is why we cannot understand what the Syrian leadership is doing in Lebanon without understanding the impact of the winds of democratic change that's really sweeping the region itself, including Syria.
We understand Syrians have satellite televisions. They've been watching what's been happening in Lebanon. Well, Professor, in the minute we have left, how much is the Bush administration going to be able to claim credit for what's happening? As some have said, they may have broken quite a few eggs in the region, but maybe they ultimately will be making the omelet, if you will.
Let's remember, Robin, here, that Arabs and Muslims have been struggling against their dictators for many years. The same dictators that our own government here in the United States fully supported. So in this particular sense, let's give credit where credit is due. It's due to the people who have been struggling against their autocrats and oppressive leaders who were fully supported by Western powers, including the United States. But I also would give the Bush administration some credit, because the administration is finally making it very clear that democracy is being used not only against its enemies, but also against its friends. And this is why I think the most important contribution that the Bush administration can make for the promotion of democracy in the Middle East is to be consistent, is to be genuine, and to make sure that allies and enemies, the same yardstick is applied to both. This is the way to go in the Middle East, and this is what Middle Easterners and Arabs and Muslims are demanding today.
Professor Fawaz Jurjis holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. He's also author of the forthcoming book, The Jihadists, Unholy Warriors. Professor Jurjis, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, refugees in Kabul are enduring a brutal winter in Afghanistan. Many children are dying, being fed opium to keep them from their pain. We'll take a look at that story. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. With Republicans in control of the White House and both the House and the Senate, the Democratic Party has its work cut out for it. Last night, speaking at the JFK Library here in Boston, former presidential candidate John Kerry seemed to blame the media for not getting out the message.
If 77% of the people who voted for George Bush on Election Day believed that weapons of mass destruction had been found in Iraq, as they did, and 77% of the people who voted for him believed that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11, as they did, then something has happened in the way in which we're talking to each other and in who is arbitrating about truth in American politics.
Kerry also said that despite November's loss, Democrats had managed to put together a strong grassroots effort and that they beat or exceeded their targets for voter turnout. So, what should the party do to regain control of Congress or win the White House? Does history offer any suggestions? Here Now's Bob Oakes posed those questions to John Gehring, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston University.
Let me ask you, first of all, to talk a little bit about the Democratic Party and what it's going through right now in its self-examination, so to speak. Is this something that has happened a lot in history to parties following elections?
Well, I think it's fair to say that any time a party loses an election, particularly a very hard-fought and close election, there's a certain amount of soul-searching and head-scratching. And in that respect, this episode is not unfamiliar. But I think that what I noticed just sort of talking with people and browsing on the web and my general sense of things is that the Democrats are perturbed. In a way that perhaps they haven't been in the past. They feel themselves to be on the defensive, rhetorically, ideologically, politically, and they are searching around and perhaps looking in a more fundamental way for big answers.
Does this have an historical equivalent?
Well, I have thought about this a bit, and you might say it approximates the situation of the Democrats at the turn of the century, because after the 1896 election, the Democrats were the minority party, really, until the New Deal. That was a period of some three decades. And during that time, there were quite distinct wings of the party. There was the Bryan wing, the left wing, if you will, the populist wing, and the conservative wing. And neither wing could make much headway electorally. But there was sort of an ongoing battle between those two factions, if you will, and those two ideological positions.
Talking about the present, it almost feels like the Democrats are splitting over philosophy at this moment, which may or may not be a correct analysis. But it seems like many Democrats are worried now that Howard Dean is going to move the party to the left. Mm-hmm. And some Democrats are saying that's just going to doom us again. We can't beat the Republicans by going in that direction.
Yeah, I think you do see that debate. On the other hand, I think it's important to remember that in the recent election, the Democrats closed ranks in a way that they hadn't, I would say, in decades. You know, when I think about the Democrats, I always think about this this quip of Will Rogers that he reportedly said, "I am not a member of an organized political party, comma, I am a Democrat." And much the same could be said of the Democrats today. But it is remarkable the extent to which they united behind John Kerry, even people who were not that excited about his candidacy. So I'm not sure that what we're seeing in the future is an extended period of internecine warfare. I think it is quite possible that the Democrats will pragmatically unite around whomever the party chooses in the next 4 years.
But the question is, even if they unite, can they win? And what I hear some people talking about, both Democrats, independents, and Republicans, is whether the Democrats, beyond whether they can be successful in electing a presidential candidate, can the Democrats stay relevant?
Well, I think they can. My view of this election is that it was just another election. I do not see a sort of harbinger of long-term trends in this election. In fact, the results are quite neatly predicted by the two-factor presidential vote models, where you look at whether there was an incumbent running for election and what the state of the economy was. I don't see an extended period of Republican dominance, although I know that some people have that view of the future.
From the historical perspective, what's the challenge for Democrats as they go forward in this process, evaluating their next step?
Well, I think that the biggest challenge for the Democrats, if you look at the things that are sort of within their power to effect, is to articulate an ideology that looks coherent to the electorate. I think that the problem of the Democratic Party in recent decades, since mid-century, has been the panoply of factions and issues and ideologies that they have attempted to bring together, and this kind of appearance of disarray. And that's a very big challenge for the Democrats. I don't think there's an easy solution to that. But if I were, in the Democratic leadership today, that's what I would be scratching my head about.
Trying to figure out how to get all these factions pushing in the same direction at the same time just before an election?
Right. Well, you know, there's something ironic about the Democrats, because if you look at issues over the course of the past 50 or 100 years, you will find that the Democrats came out ultimately on the winning side. Let's look at racial issues. Let's look at gay rights. Let's look at a variety of social issues, including abortion to some extent, and certainly economic issues, the vast expansion of government responsibilities, increasing environmental regulations and so forth. On all of these issues, the Democrats have ultimately won. And the Republicans have been backtracking. And yet the general perception is that it's the Republicans who are on the offensive and the Democrats who are on the defensive. And so I would say that in many ways the Democrats have won the policy war but lost the rhetorical war.
They don't sell themselves well.
There's a big problem.
So then you don't believe that the Democrats either overtly or subtly are about to morph into something else, the Democratic Party, that is?
It is often difficult to see the next big thing coming down the pike, you know, until it's there. But I cannot foresee what that next big thing would be. In other words, I do not see the Democratic Party message over the past 50 years, which I think is perhaps best encapsulated by the concept of universalism or inclusion, this idea of grouping together under a big tent a whole array of issues that in some way incorporate those who are, you know, have been at the bottom, have been oppressed by American society. I don't see that basic message changing. I don't see any reason for it to change. I don't see any electoral momentum against that that sort of core ideology, because I think there is a coherent message in the Democratic Party, but I don't think it has been seen or articulated very effectively in recent years.
John Gehring is author of the book Party Ideologies in America, 1828 to 1996. He's also professor of political science at Boston University and spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. And still to come, actor Brian Dennehy plays the part of a great screenwriter and remembers a great playwright. Dennehy on Dalton Trumbo and Arthur Miller coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. A 29-year-old Massachusetts woman died after a 16-year-old snowboarder crashed into her at Jackson Hole Mountain Resort in Wyoming last Friday. The snowboarder faces charges of manslaughter and reckless behavior. And the death of the woman highlights the dangers winter sports enthusiasts face and also raises the question, who's liable? Joining us on the line from Salt Lake City, Utah, is Mark Guido. He's editor of First Tracks, an online ski magazine. And, Mark, how common is this? Maybe not death, but severe injury from these collisions.
Well, certainly collisions do occur with more and more folks enjoying skiing and snowboarding on the hills. Serious injuries, however, do seem to be relatively rare.
But that we hear about them at all, some people say, you know, is wrong. This is a place where people go to have fun. What are skiers saying? What is the controversy on the slopes?
Well, certainly there are certain segments of the population on the slopes that have a skier versus snowboarder mentality, but it's not about the tool that you're using to slide down the hill. It's about the brain and the awareness of the person who's actually got the tool strapped to their feet.
Really? Because some slopes outlaw snowboards or at least segregate them. The feeling is that there's less control over snowboards and more young boys are riding them.
Well, the testosterone poisoning affects users of both devices. There are only four ski areas left in the entire United States that actually still ban snowboarding, and none that I'm aware of that actually segregate the populations. Those four holdouts that have chosen to remain skiing only have done so to satisfy a market niche that's not satisfied elsewhere.
Yeah, they don't want to have snowboards on the runs with them. But you said again that it doesn't matter what you strap on your feet. It's the way, how responsible someone is on the slopes. And that reminds us that isn't there a case, in fact, involving a skier who hit and killed another skier, a landmark case, and that reckless skier went to jail?
That's correct. That was the case of Nathan Hall, was the defendant, and that was in Colorado. It's a state-by-state issue. Skier responsibility code is something that's advocated by the National Ski Areas Association, and that applies to both skiers and snowboarders as far as who has what responsibility on the hill.
We understand that in many areas, if you buy a lift ticket, it says right on the lift ticket that the resort has no liability.
Well, liability disclaimers are common in the recreation industry, not only exclusively to the ski industry. But a lot of it boils down to common sense, how you react to others around you, especially in a crowded situation where you have people of varying abilities all utilizing the same slopes.
Right. And well, what are the laws when laws are enacted?
Some limit the liability of a ski area operator. There's currently a bill pending before the Connecticut State Senate to modify the potential liability of ski area operators in Connecticut, for example. Others are Good Samaritan laws, like what exists in Vermont, as far as helping out an injured skier. Others, such as what Colorado has passed, actually provide criminal penalties for reckless behavior on the slopes.
We understand many ski areas pulled passes. Breckenridge apparently pulled more than 50 passes last season. Keystone pulled between 20 and 50 each season. Boy, if they're pulling that many passes, what is that saying to you?
It merely indicates that folks are not always exhibiting the behavior that they need to exhibit. In a lot of cases, the ski patrol will pull a pass, but then return it to the pass holder after completion of safety training, responsibility training, et cetera.
So Mark Guido, editor of Fast Tracks, an online ski magazine, obviously a fan of the sport. Many people think this is a problem that needs addressing. Your thoughts?
It's a problem that's existed as long as people have been sharing the slopes together. It's nothing new. The only thing that's changed is the introduction of snowboarders to the mix. It's something that's causing a lot of folks to venture into the backcountry now and escape the lift-surf ski area for just that reason.
Mark Guido, editor of First Track's online ski magazine, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. Young, It's Here and Now. Actor Brian Dennehy has secured a place as one of the great interpreters of American stage characters, most notably Willie Loman from Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. But right now, Dennehy is embodying Dalton Trumbo, the blacklisted Cold War-era screenwriter who wrote Exodus, Spartacus, and Roman Holiday. Dennehy stars in the Boston production of Trumbo, a story told mainly through the many letters Dalton Trumbo wrote, including those to people he felt had betrayed him, studio executives in particular.
My affection caused me to assert your ability to producers when you were out of favor. Yours impelled you to cry out against me in the most fatal hour of my career.
We recently visited the Calderwood Pavilion during a soundcheck to talk to Dennehy about both Arthur Miller and Dalton Trumbo. Both were called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Trumbo would spend time in jail.
The fact is that Trumbo certainly had been a communist and was certainly a political radical. But as he says in this theater piece, the whole point about America is that you're not supposed to be punished for opinion.
How lucky for us that a screenwriter writes letters.
Yeah.
Religious discrimination. You belong to that legion of men who traditionally sacrificed their brothers to gain a little more time for themselves. The shuddering, exquisite, sensitive men who quietly deplore injustice while dining upon its victim.
What were some of the other things that he wrote about?
Oh, he wrote about lots of things. Politics, of course, were very important to him, but he also wrote about, he wrote a wonderful letter that we quote almost, I guess, in its entirety to his son about masturbation, which is hilarious. But he wrote about everything. Wrote a book called Johnny Got His Gun, which is probably the best anti-war book ever written. Also made a movie of it later on, which he directed. He was an enormously prolific guy.
It's such an interesting time for you, Brian Dennehy, because here in these couple of weeks you have this affiliation with two writers who went through the same period of time.
Yeah, Arthur Miller. Arthur Miller was subpoenaed in 1956. Miller refused to cooperate. By that time, the Supreme Court wasn't having any of this. In fact, a month after he testified in 1956, he married Marilyn Monroe. And he himself, Arthur, claims that he was contacted, or his attorney was contacted by someone on the committee saying that if Miller would agree to pose for photographs with Marilyn and members of the committee, that they would forget about the subpoena, which, I mean, to me is so hilarious. But, Arthur died last week. I saw him about a week before he died in the hospital in New York. It was a very kind of poignant goodbye. Certainly I had the feeling that I probably wouldn't see him again. Having said that, when it happened, when it came, it was a shock. He was an extraordinary guy, and you don't meet very many great men in your life, and certainly Arthur was one of them, if not the greatest, and yet he was a friend. I'll miss him. He just had this great appetite for everything about life, including reading and thinking about life and studying it. Death of a Salesman, interestingly enough, is stuff based on his life, and his own experiences in the 30s and the Depression. I did that play 450 times. I'm going to do it again, starting in London in May, for another 200, 250 times. I never get tired of playing it. That play hits the audience in a place that no other play seems to.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that it's about the American dream and how easily the dream can be denied. And the fact that for most of us it is denied, especially when it comes to the family scenes, you know, the sense of it didn't work. You know, the interesting thing, Arthur said this one night, and it's true. He said, Willie is the only person who doesn't think that Willie has failed to be a success is himself.
What did Arthur Miller say to you about playing Willie Loman? Anything?
He liked it. He liked my performance. We did it in Chicago, which is, you know, he would always allow countless productions, except in New York. It could only be done on Broadway by a production that he personally would authorize. It was done originally by Lee J. Cobb and Elia Kazan. And then some 15 years or so, 20 years after that, by George Scott. And then Dustin Hoffman's production, which was, I'm guessing, about 1978 or 80, and then ours. He came out to see it, liked it, decided that it would come into New York.
But what happens? Does he say, listen, I got a little insight about Willie?
He never really said too much. I mean, he would make notes. I remember one time he said, Brian, in that scene in the bar, you're forgetting a phrase or a line. I said, what? I said, really, what is it? He said, at the end of the sentence, he says, oh. And you're leaving out the oh. And you know what? I listened to everything he had to say about it. I asked him one day, kind of casually, I said, what does Willie sell? What is he? He's on the road selling. He's a salesman. What does he sell? And Arthur said, himself. And I often thought about that. You know, he sells himself. He also told a great story about being on a subway train and realizing a critical thing about that production. He saw a guy, a well-dressed guy, older guy, with a big sample case between his legs, neatly dressed, but the clothes a little bit worn. He was just standing and holding on to one of these posts in the subway, obviously moving between sales stops, and having this intense conversation. We've all seen people like that in buses and subways. And Arthur realized that that man was inhabiting the present, but also inhabiting the past, and that's what he had to do with Willie.
Brian Dennehy talking about Arthur Miller as we sit on the stage where he's performing Trumbo, Dalton Trumbo, who went through the Crucible and went to prison. Arthur Miller, who wrote the Crucible after going through the Inquisition of the McCarthy era. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks. It was fun.
There were promises made across this desk. You wasn't telling me. You've got people to see. I put 34 years into this firm, Howard, and now I can't pay my insurance. You can't eat the orange and throw the peel away. A man is not a piece of fruit. Now pay attention!
Brian Dennehy as Willie Loman in the Tony Award-winning 1999 production of Death of a Salesman. And Dennehy is currently playing blacklisted screenwriter Dalton Trumbo in the Huntington Theater Company's production of Trumbo here in Boston. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes April Peavy, Karen Miller-Medson, Kevin Sullivan, Lynn Menegon, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Special thanks today to George Hicks. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deb Becker. Our interns are Danielle Dreilinger and Kate Goldring. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. Feel better, Mark. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now. Thank you.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com. I'm Rob.